Welcome to a new episode of Demand Gen Chat. I'm your host, Tara Robertson, head of Demand Gen here at Chili Piper. In this episode, I'm joined by Jody Saratani, VP of Revenue Marketing at Rollworks. We chat about her marketing team's approach to ABM and how MQLs factor into their strategy. Jody also shares the programs her team has recently had to cut back on due to low performance. That one probably won't be a surprise to many of you listening. And what their team is excited about now. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jody. Jody, welcome to Demand Gen Chat. I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm super excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. I'd love to start off with something fun. It sounds like you have something that you disagree with, maybe a hot take that you want to kind of disagree with for our audience. So I'd love to jump right into that.
Yeah, I mean, it might surprise you knowing that I come from the account-based marketing and selling space. But unlike many, you know, so-called ABM thought leaders, and even some of our account-based marketing peers or competitors at Rollworks, we really don't believe that the MQL is dead. So we're going against the grain a little bit there. We consider ourselves pragmatists and practitioners more than thought leaders. And frankly, we'll believe the MQL is dead when sales does. And today, there's really not a sales channel or sales interaction that doesn't require a qualified person's involvement, right? It's something that on the marketing side, you can target an account. But on the sales side, it really comes down to people. So the odds are to sales and to Rollworks, the MQL will never be dead. It's just too important. But having said that, we do believe that marketers are really under pressure and have a sincere obligation to drive higher quality MQLs with a fit-focused approach. Sometimes, you know, it's not that. There's still too many marketers, I would say, that we see who define, you know, maybe their lead scoring program with having that activity side and the, you know, the fit side sort of be equally weighted, or they see the MQL as being kind of the be all and end all to their top of funnel. And both of those things mean that a lot of times for those companies, poor fit MQLs slip through, and that can really muddy the overall funnel and not really serve sales the way that we need to. So having said that, if fit is assumed and it is a focus of the marketing organization and of the lead scoring program, you know, we believe there's nothing wrong with the MQL sort of in and of itself. The problem to us is a little bit more nuanced when it comes to top of funnel definition. To us, when the activity that drives an MQL is necessarily a form fill, right? And when the MQL is kind of the sole measure of top of funnel progress, you know, that's when things become a bit trickier and unbalanced. To us, a form fill is just one action, right? That indicates, interest from a prospective buyer. It's an important signal, but it's just one signal. And the reality is there are so many other interactions at the people, at the person or the account level that can be really, really valuable to sales. You know, we know in B2B, typically only 2-3% of B2B site visitors actually fill out a form when they're interacting with your website. So waiting for a form fill actually has the risk of ignoring maybe 97%, 98% available buyer interactions that could indicate readiness, just like the form fill does. So we really see there's an opportunity to expand the number of signals and the categories of signals that you care about at the top of the funnel and that you're using to pass along to sales, just like you would a form-filling MQL, to really expand your top of funnel and increase the number of at-bats that you're delivering to sales.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I want to start with how does the Rollworks... Yeah, it's a good one. I think you're right. Coming from an ABM background, I wasn't expecting you to touch on MQLs.
So I know. They're all like, so, it's dead, it's over, you know, but... Not so fast.
So I'd love to hear how your team defines an MQL and what type of leads you're passing over to sales. And then kind of the flip side of that, how do you score if you do any account scoring as well? How does that layer on?
Yeah. So on the MQL side, we have, you know, when I say fit focused, for us, it's almost fit exclusive, right? So we use, you know, our own tool to have a data-backed definition of our ideal customer profile and a scored, you know, target account list it's a larger target account list. So our overall TAM is something like 50,000 accounts. Our target account list in any period typically is about 10,000 accounts. So it's pretty big, maybe different than what folks might initially think of, where they think of it as like their top 100 accounts. And by the way, we do have top 100 accounts as well for one-to-one programming. But when we've sort of blended the scale of traditional demand generation with the precision of ABM and this approach, where our TAL is actually what we use to target across channels. And it's really powerful. In the last few years, most channels and most vendors can actually be ABMified, right? You can give them that list of 10,000 accounts and the specific members of the buying committee that you want to go after and pay a slight premium, you know, potentially for that level of targeting. But what the net is that every single engagement that you get from that channel and vendor fit is assumed. So for us, that's sort of like the starting point, is that we're focusing darn near exclusively on our TAL, with the exception of Google search, where you can't, you know, focus on a TAL specifically. Every other channel that we use, we're focused on our TAL, you know, almost exclusively. So that means that the form fills that are coming in from paid programs or partner programs are by definition members of the buying committee on our target account list. So that sort of, you know, accelerates their likelihood to convert to an MQL. Additionally, in our scoring program, we use Marketo. In our scoring program, we accelerate. So if you are the right person from our target account list, you don't have to work very hard in order to get on, you know, to the MQL stage. Our sellers, their disposition is they're willing to, you know, react to darn near everything if it's the right person from the right organization. So a blog post or, you know, an email click, that's enough for them to use as an impetus for outreach because it's such a high value target. So that really makes sure that our MQL is, you know, basically fit exclusive. The reality is that there's going to be folks that come in inbound. You can't control it completely. So we do not, you know, we do have some noise that people find us and they're interested, they're not the right fit, or they're not on our target account list. So then we have, you know, the normal scoring that makes sure that they're working hard and they're doing the right things looking more on their demographic and firmographic side as opposed to a target account list match. So that's on the MQL side, but we don't use MQLs alone. Like I said, we believe that there are multiple signals, and we certainly have seen the power of using multiple signals at the top of the funnel. So we have four distinct kind of clusters of signals. On kind of the least valuable, but not valuable, is the buyer intelligence around intent. So intent is not new, but I think what turns an intent data point into an intent buying signal is actually having corroborating data sources that tell you on multiple sources of intent. So for us, we use Bobora, we use Rollworks' own keyword intent, as well as G2 intent data that says if two out of the three are telling us that now is, you know, the time that account is consuming third-party, you know, bottom of funnel topics or keywords, then they're ready for outreach. And that's really opened up a powerful pocket of demand for our sellers. We also have, you know, account scoring. It's part of the Rollworks platform. But for us, we've developed a really customized model that looks across people and account level data points. And we've co-created that with our sales team, just like we did the MQL, right? That says we care about, you know, email opens, we care about, you know, a certain volume of ad clicks, site engagement, et cetera. So you can kind of pull in those DM, you know, those anonymous engagements and really look across the whole account instead of a single individual. And we pass those MQAs along to our sales team as well. And then the final category is actually a new capability that we're launching in just a couple of weeks, but I'm happy to share with you here.
Sure.
We call them hot contacts. And it's really just a game changer because it's effectively de-anonymized contacts. So it has the power of turning kind of awareness investments or awareness into demand generation. Because instead of, you know, driving someone to your site and they've never opted in, so you can't have the match between your map or your CRM and that site visit, Rollworks has a really powerful de-anonymization capability. And so we're able to de-anonymize a certain percent of your site traffic. So when somebody clicks an ad or they visit a web page, even if they haven't, or I guess exclusively if they haven't ever filled out a form, we can tell you who that person is. So that's the kind of, fourth and final bucket of signals that we pass along to our sales team. And that really gives us a much, much wider understanding of buyers, true buyers that are in market, that goes way beyond just a form filling MQL, but has sort of fit baked into to every level.
And is your sales team trialing that out right now? Or are you waiting to get your hands on it?
Yeah.
You sound excited about it.
On it early. We've been an alpha customer for some time. It's got a lot of power because like I said, it's invisible typically. I think what the aha for marketers are that, you know, for the marketer, you need the opt-in, right? It's part of the CAN-SPAM law criteria. So we're sort of like attached to the form fill because you get that opt-in. But for the sales team, they don't need an opt-in to call somebody, to send them an email, to email them. They don't need that. They just need to know who that person is, identify them, you know, with contact information and associated account, and some provocation for outreach. So it's a different game. So if you're really aligned with sales, and you deconstruct, you know, how you think about a lead or an MQL, the form fill, again, is not necessary. So that's where Hot Contacts is kind of a revolutionary product capability that we're really excited to deliver to our customers.
That's very cool. Yeah. And I'm curious, you mentioned you work with sales to define MQAs, I'm assuming MQLs as well. Mm-hmm. Have you had any challenges I'm sure you have, most of us have, over the last few months of, first of all, hitting those targets that you kind of promised as a marketing team to deliver on to sales? And have you been making any adjustments on how you're defining what you pass over?
I mean, I would say that the MQA and the MQL, by definition, is not a set and forget. There are some things, I'm not against it. Like, there's so many cool, you know, machine learning capabilities and AI that a lot of times you can sort of set and forget things, but not the MQA and MQL. So we're always learning and optimizing, tweaking, making sure that, you know, for example, if we have, you know, new SDRs coming on board and suddenly we've got, you know, more juniors SDRs, we probably need to work a little harder on the marketing side to drive, you know, deeper, you know, engagement with the product to make those at-bats, you know, a layup for them. Whereas if you've got experienced SDRs, they can typically do more with colder outreach. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, something to know. So it's always a work in process. Having said that, you know, the last few months, honestly, Tara, we're lucky because we're in the ABM space. And so a lot of people are, you know, reconsidering and scrutinizing their investments. But account-based marketing or an account-based approach, that whole methodology is almost by definition, you know, zero waste. So it kind of naturally is efficient. And so we've actually there's been no blip for us so far on the responsiveness that we've seen. Our email, we have noticed that there's more soft bounces, I think, because there's been, you know, we sell to the mid-market. There's a lot of folks that have been had a lot of team changes or riffs. So we have noticed that and have had to pivot outside of email being a big driver of demand. What we have noticed that the buying committee has gotten wider. So a lot of our customers have an additional person, maybe even having the CEO or president being involved in these final decisions, which has expanded the number of days that we're talking with folks, days or weeks that we're talking with folks. So we have to, you know, make sure that we're, you know, really being tight with our business case, and we have to drive the urgency. They're not necessarily going to drive it from their side, which is a change. But I don't think that has changed our MQA or MQL definition. It just underscores how important it is that again, we're looking across signals and, you know, making sure that we're not just looking at data, we're looking at sources of intelligence. And to me, that's looking at multiple data points that means something. Maybe there's a break from the norm, or there's, you know, kind of a collection of data points that say, you know, this is meaningful. So that's kind of been the way that we've been, I would say, offensive to what's happening in the economy. But I don't want to take total credit for it, because we are lucky in the space that we're in, that that there still is a lot of interest, and it's not, it doesn't seem to be one of the categories just yet that people are holistically cutting. They seem to actually be like, I'm going to de-emphasize these other things that maybe have a little bit less precision at the and focus more on the motions that have more precision. So
yeah, that makes total sense, that if you have an account list that you're working from anyway, that would be the focus right now. When things have to be efficient and you need to show ROI, you don't want to cut your account-based programs. On the note of things take like longer sales cycles, selling to the executive team, sometimes CEO, obviously CFO comes up a ton lately. Yes. Is that typically something that you're working with your sales team to figure out, or is marketing running any initiatives to help kind of bridge that gap?
My background is in revenue marketing. So until October of this year, my focus was, you know, on all things impact, is particularly pipeline revenue. And because of also having customer marketing roll into me, retaining and expanding revenue. But recently, you know, in October, I was, I now head up the whole marketing team. So definitely on the product marketing side, we were really trying to be agile as new members of the buying committee get added, you know, knowing that ultimately you're selling to someone who's selling to someone else is right. Kind of that, you know what I mean? You're influencing the influencer. And sometimes those folks, like your CEOs, or presidents or CFOs or CMOs, you don't get a lot of FaceTime with them, typically no FaceTime with them. So you really need to make sure the assets that you're sending can translate really, really well. So the short answer is yes, we're very connected into the entire buying process. We organize our business based off of buying stage. And so there's the consideration stage, which is pipeline, qualified pipeline development, and then the buying stage, which is obviously going to close one, et cetera. So, you know, I and a couple members of my team sit in on the buying foundation's weekly business review. So we're listening to what's happening and keeping really in tune with what we're seeing, and then making decisions about how we're investing our own time to support and make sure that the close rate remains strong, and we're kind of plowing through any barriers that are coming up. And I think that at first when we went with like the weekly business review format, I'll be honest, I was like, weekly? Like, not that I wasn't looking at the numbers weekly. I mean, I'm looking at the numbers daily, but to actually have to like analyze and come up with like comments, action items, discussion, you know, it just felt like a little bit like we were watching paint dry. But in this environment, I actually am like, yeah, that was the right move to make, because things are changing very much, you know, where we had a couple weeks ago, SVB going under, that really impacted a lot of our customers. There was a few very dicey days there where we're like, okay, you know, who knows who this is going to be? And we had to kind of think through it. That was just a day by day thing. And 2023 has been very dynamic like that. So I think weekly is actually the right cadence, and continuing to be committed to be in tune with what exactly is happening with our market, and making sure that our processes really, really are aligned.
Yeah, you're right though. Weekly, it's one thing to look at numbers. It's a total other list of to-dos to have kind of a story or context behind each metric that you're presenting on. I'd love to hear a little bit about what metrics you're covering in those weeklies, and just things that you're keeping an eye on personally week over week.
So I co-lead the Consideration Foundation as well as the Awareness Foundation. But on the Consideration Foundation, effectively, our North Star is qualified pipeline. So we're looking at qualified to us is kind of in the middle of the sales process. So it's not like a new appointment or a new opportunity being generated. It actually, you know, post demo, where we've gotten the commitment that buyer is willing to put in the time. They've got a timeline. They, you know, we've identified kind of the key stakeholders, blah, 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 blah. So, and then we're also focused on that dollar amount because that's one of the levers. Volume alone isn't going to cut it. So that's our North Star metric. And then we're looking at kind of leading and lagging indicators of whether or not, you know, that North Star metric, we're going to hit it. And if it means what it's supposed to mean in terms of its conversion to the next stage. So what's happening, you know, kind of post qualified pipeline amount. So a few things that matter as kind of leading indicators. We're looking at, you know, those four different buckets of signals, like how many high intent accounts are we passing over in the period relative to the target? How many MQAs are we passing over, you know, and what's that pacing look like relative to the target? Same with hot contacts and same with, you know, MQLs. And then we're looking at the conversion rates for each of those to appointments and you know, also the sources, whether it's marketing source, SDR source, you know, referral from our partner program or NBS, which is our AEs, like self-generated pipeline, you know, just seeing how we're pacing against the assumptions and the targets. And that kind of gets us to, you know, the qualified deal volume, qualified deal dollar amount, average deal size. And we're also looking at open and reply rates from the SDRs, SDR productivity, you know, our top of funnel to appointment conversion rate. I'm listing all these things, but effectively it's like, what are all the things that we know are big picture levers that can give us confidence that we're going to hit the number, or is something that we know that it's like the 20% that equals 80%. If something's off, it's impossible to make up, right? Or, you know, versus like, you know, there's so many stats out there that it does take a little moment to kind of understand exactly for your business, what are all the things that would, you know, indicate you're on track versus you're off track. And then we're also looking at kind of the qualified to, close rate, just making sure that like, okay, that qualified pipeline really means something to the buying foundation. So it's a lot of data to look at, but it becomes very, you know, very meaningful when you're looking at week over week trends, when you're looking at pacing, when you're looking at, you know, all these different areas. We also have it broken out by segment and stuff like that. So it's become very, I won't say easy, but routine. And I do think that it's operationalized something that's been a little bit more a practice of mine, but it's just exposing it to the broader business because we do present it to our CEO and, you know, so he's very in tune with our part of the business. So I've come to really like it. Like I said, at first I was like, weekly is like crazy, but now I've come to really like it. I actually just had it before our call where we were able to kind of share the overall narrative, share what we were learning, share what we were doing about it. It definitely increases your pace of work.
And for setting up those dashboards, that weekly reporting, is that done at the marketing operations level, or is there a separate data or RevOps team that owns that reporting?
Yeah, we have a RevOps team that's independent of marketing or sales. Within RevOps, we've got sales ops and, you know, marketing ops and CX ops, so three sort of branches of RevOps. So they own the actual, you know, creating of the dashboard and the pulling of the numbers. The analysis is done by the SDR leader and myself. We just have more of the context of like, does this matter? Does this pass the sniff test? Is this high for industry average? Is it low? Like things like that. It sometimes, you know, it's just a kind of good division of labor where they're putting the literal numbers in and doing the math, but then we're doing the analysis and we sort of know what's happening and can kind of give, is it a people issue? Or, you know, factor, not always a bad thing, but like if it's a people factor, is it a process factor, is it a system factor? We know those things sort of intuitively, as well as know kind of what's normal having been, you know, in these types of roles for a long, long time. So the analysis they're not doing, but the numbers and the dashboard setup and the updating of the numbers is the RevOps org in our business.
Yeah, I'm hearing that more and more, having the centralized RevOps or just ops as its own function. I think it makes a ton of sense, obviously, for having numbers consistent throughout the funnel. So you're not looking at different reporting than sales, which can happen sometimes.
Yes.
You touched a little bit on marketing source pipeline. I'm curious to know if anything has been working exceptionally well for your team the last couple of months in terms of driving that new pipeline, or maybe in that consideration stage, if there's anything you're doing that seems to be really moving the needle there.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's not very sexy to say, but we're a little bit back to basics right now. You know, like I think that there's sort of been, I would say that as a marketing leader, in a high growth environment, I've learned that you always have to have a certain percentage of your, you know, your team's time and your dollars invested in things that are new. So, cause you always are going to hit a point of diminishing return on a lot of the channels, partners, you know, vendors that you're working with. You need to be testing. And I'll be honest, in our business and in B2B marketing, things change so quickly that if you're 6 months, you know, behind and you're not kind of at the tip of the spear, you quickly become archaic and things go sideways. But these days, it's a little bit different in terms of our disposition, where we are kind of going back to the basics, you know, and we're really focused on the data and buyer intelligence, like I said, that we have. We believe that in 2023 and 2024, even though we're in, you know, a slightly advantaged place from an industry perspective, we do believe that there's just going to be fewer true buyers this year and potentially next than there have been previously. So I think that the difference between generating demand and generating like engagement is really important to differentiate. And what are your demand signals? And do you have complete visibility into those demand signals at the moment where they become a signal? So we're focused very much on the automated orchestrated programs that react to a change in state, a change mm-hmm. in buying stage or state that says, hey, you know, they've reached a critical threshold, because we know that if they are a buyer and they are doing things that are bottom of funnel, whether that's on our first party properties or third party properties, that we only have so much time to sort of reach them and meet them at that point in their journey before they make a decision. And that could be that they make a decision to go with a competitor. So mm-hmm. we're very focused on you know, having our data house and our buying intelligence house, I guess, in order, and really thoughtfully organizing our programming so that, you know, we react to that more or less in real time and launch a relevant offer in a relevant channel for that prospective customer. So it's not terribly sexy, but I think it really is real, and the tools exist now to make all that come to life. I think that there's, for as long as I've been in marketing, there's been the thing of like right person or right account, right message, right time. Mm-hmm. But the plumbing hasn't always been available to make all of these tools and technologies talk to each other and really kind of understand, you know, all the different data points. I think we don't talk about it a lot in marketing, but the reality is that our central nervous system is often the marketing automation platform. But if you're truly, you know, thinking from a outside in perspective, there's all these other data points that are happening where people are consuming information about you or your competition or your category and or interacting with other parts of the business, like on the sales side. And because the map is just only has sort of, it has blinders on some of those things, like, are they opening sales emails? Are they replying to sales emails? Are they comparing you to competitor on G2? Like all these different things that they often live in disparate places, or they're limited to like a single contact and not tied up to the account, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Those things have huge implications for a 360 understanding of your buyer pool. And so I guess, yeah, long story short, we're just making sure that information is complete. It's deep, it's wide, it's accurate. Because with that in mind, all the other tools are out there to launch the right campaign at the right moment, as long as you've got the insight there, as long as you've got the intelligence there.
Yeah. I think a lot of teams, like you said, we've been talking about right person, right content, right time. for years and years, but it's finally coming to that place where we can actually get in front of those people. So that's exciting as a marketer. I think you also mentioned diminishing returns. I'm a huge believer that especially in B2B, we can't all just be doing the same thing because it won't work. We've seen that with things like everyone using the same subject lines for outreach emails, and now they're all the same, so they stopped work. Do you have a set amount of, maybe it's a team or a budget that you allocate to those tests, or is it kind of fluid right now and you just figure out where you should move things around?
Yeah, it differs every period. So we plan typically in the half, first half, second half. And what I'll, you know, do based off of sort of the strategy of the business and how we're sort of thinking about things, as well as, and you know, other factors like total budget, I'll put together kind of a frame of reference for my my demand gen leader, who will use that as sort of a guiding principle, and a certain percent should be test, certain percent should be tried and proven. So as a matter of practice, you know, knowing nothing else, I would always say at least 20% is your test versus your try to prove it. And it could be test might be a new partner, it might be a new vendor in the same channel, or it might be an entirely new channel, you know, altogether. So it can vary. Right now, because of what's happening in the economy and just being a bit more conservative, our test is only about 10%, which I would say I've never had that direction for the team, but we're kind of in unprecedented times where we're just doubling down on using what we know to be effective to reach people at the right time, assuming that the data is there. But generally it's a little bit healthier. I would say in a younger company, or, you know, if you're going after a new market, you got a new product, definitely higher, because you're, you know, when I joined RealWorks, we're only a 5-year-old company. So I joined about 3.5 years ago, early stages of you know, revenue generation for us. And it was probably 50-50 at that point, because it was like, we didn't know, you know, we're just testing all these different things. Yeah. But over time, we're starting to know what's tried and proven. We've got definitely our kind of bread and butter partnerships or vendors, channels that we know our audience hangs out in, and we can reach them cost effectively. So it's changed over time. But right now it's 90-10 rule of thumb, typically, you know, for SaaS companies, 80-20, but some cases, you know, depending on how old your business is and or how established your product line is, et cetera, it might be higher.
That makes a lot of sense as guidance. I mean, everyone's business is different, like you said, but you have to have some kind of guidelines. Other than bringing that testing budget down to around 10%, is there anything else you've had to either cut or pause, just again, because things are so uncertain right now and you just want to double down on what's working?
Yeah, I mean, I think our budget and our ROI will always be a factor, always be scrutinized, right? And that, I think, is something you just accept if you're in these types of roles, that you have an obligation to the business to return that investment. So, you know, we'll always be keeping an eye on where we're seeing, you know, a positive ROI and where we're not. Having said that, like there's one, I guess, category that we've noticed hasn't had their return, and that is large conferences. So we just haven't seen that come back online for our audience. There's exceptions. We definitely went to B2B MX recently. That's kind of in our sweet spot, so there's a lot of, you know, account-based, forward-thinking marketing and sales leaders there. We also have a very large partnership with HubSpot, so we'll be going big again at HubSpot Inbound this year. That was definitely an exceptional event for us. But I would say we've pulled back pretty heavily on large conferences. And instead, when it comes to in-person activations, we're focused more on, you know, smaller bespoke dinners and those types of engagements. That seems to just fit the appetite of what people are willing to do. I'm not sure if it's like the COVID hangover and folks don't want to be shaking hands and sneezing on each other. I'm not sure. But we just haven't seen, you know, the vendors will say, or the partners will say, you know, we've got great reg, but the drop off is pretty extreme. We have people don't show up. And the overall engagement at the conference relative to the investment that we're making you know, it just hasn't been there. It's just so expensive, right? You send people, like at Inbound, we sent, you know, 25 people, you know, it was a massive investment from a time and a budget perspective. That one ended up working, but a lot of the other ones, not so much. So I would say that's the one area that we have cut pretty materially this year. And we're just kind of watching it to see how the market changes and if people do want to go back to these larger conferences in our space. I think we're lucky because in the COVID times, we didn't have that as an option. So we really, pushed into the outer edges of impact that virtual events and webinars could possibly give us. So we're focusing a little bit more on the virtual engagement than we are large in-person engagements. And I would say that is a change for us.
And are you struggling with getting people to attend those virtual events as well? Because that's something I've heard anecdotally is people don't want to attend either type of event now. People are just burnt out in general. So curious
totally.
How that's going.
We get 50% drop off. But what we found in terms of unlocking demand is that the attendance isn't actually required to make it a sales opportunity for us. So we've identified there's a couple of different sort of plays that we could use within that investment that unlocks the demand, regardless of whether or not they actually show up. So the two things I'll mention is on the virtual event side, using gifting as a strategy and having SDRs, you know, reach out pre-event and buy a qualified prospect lunch virtually, right? Because I'm a DoorDash, so that as they're on the computer consuming the content, you know, they can eat. Even if they don't go, they can still use it and they appreciate the gesture. So that's one thing on the virtual event side that's helped, turn the lead generation, so to speak, into true demand generation for our sales team. And on the webinar side, we've noticed that even though webinars are often, 30 minutes plus, there isn't the appetite to sit through a 30-minute webinar. I don't care who you are. Maybe some of the super big names or analysts or something that it's different. But for the most of us who are just regular old practitioners, maybe not. So what we've been doing is we've been doing sort of like the TLDR, kind of synopsis as a cheat sheet or a one-page takeaway that folks can sort of consume and get the main meat without having to consume the webinar or even a short video highlights reel, just to match kind of the level of investment that they're willing to make. And that's a really powerful follow-up for the SDR team. Saw you didn't, make it, Tara. I summarized the webinar for you, or I cut this video for you that gives like the top highlights, and it's 3 minutes or whatever. So both of those things have allowed us to continue to bear fruit from maybe a slightly exhausted channel. So it's not what you think, but we still invest in them. We still get a lot of demand from them. We just kind of are a little bit more, clever, I guess, or different in the way that we use those engagements. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's smart. You've noticed that people aren't willing to sit through half an hour, but you still want them to get the message that you're trying to get across. So again, trying to meet them where they are and get that in front of them. How they want it, not maybe they don't want to sit through a 30-minute video, but they do want to know your key points. So that's really Indeed. Smart. Great. And looking ahead to the rest of this year, is there anything you're looking forward to, or maybe your team is looking forward to testing out?
I mean, I might be alone here, but I'm actually kind of excited for 2023 and some of the circumstances that are finally sort of forcing the behavioral change that we probably needed to all make for some time, but weren't under as much pressure. And that's really, around the efficiency component. Facebook isn't the only company where this is the year of efficiency. I think a lot of, it's starting to become a very buzzy word. I'm excited to see that transformation. I'm a big proponent of marketing belonging in the kind of inner circle, in the strategy side of the business as a business leader, first, and then a marketer sort of second. And I think the disconnect has sort of been that we haven't been forced to take responsibility for the ultimate P&L of the business. We've been focused on potentially growth and in making investments for growth, But what about those efficiency, you know, how much revenue per seller, you know, what's your LTV to CAC, et cetera? I think this is, it's been a little bit like, the exception, not the rule. And now that that is, there's so much external pressure for marketers to be very, very laser focused on efficiency, i.e., you know, lower the costs and make sure the growth is there in these kind of macro ratios. I think that that'll help us finally earn that seat at the table. So even though it might be a bit painful, depending on where you are in that journey, I think it has the potential to be extremely powerful for the whole discipline of marketing. Because once we get our, you know, our efficiency in line and we really know how to squeeze the most blood out of the rock, so to speak, that's going to mean that we belong in that inner circle, in that boardroom, in the places where very big strategy decisions are being made, and that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, I think you're one of the first people to say you're excited about this year in general. So that's a positive note to end on. But I do think you're right about the strategic piece. I think we're all going to learn maybe much quicker than we would have if we had just been in kind of regular times marketing for 10 years. It'll be an accelerated version.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree, but I'm here for it. I think we're going to come out the other side, having gotten a company through embattled times, which, I mean, I always say, like, if you're a marketer at Slack, like, and you're driving growth, like, it's a little bit different than, like, if you're a marketer at a younger company in a younger space, or, you know, maybe a space that's having some challenges right now. I think now is the time where you really prove your stuff. And you know, not only have that on your resume as being potentially a key member of a team that was able to kind of get a company through a difficult period. I mean, what power that is for the rest of your career. So that's very exciting. And then, like I said, I think not really understanding the cost side of things and really taking ownership for ultimate efficiency as a marketer or marketing leader has always been, I think, our Achilles heel that's kept us out of these really strategic conversations. And after this year, I'm guessing that it's going to be a thing of the past.
I think you're right about that. So a lot of us have a lot of learning to do to catch up and to make sure that we're strong revenue marketers the way that people like yourself have become over time.
Indeed.
Thanks so much, Jody. So quick fire round, a couple questions for you. Is there another marketer you follow that our listeners should go check out, maybe to learn more about the revenue side of the business?
You know, it's an interesting question. I wish I had an easy answer, but I've noticed that there's actually sort of a disconnect between thought leaders and people that, like, you know, have a following and they're very present. They're writing books or they're, you know, whatever, doing a lot of speaking engagements. I mean, maybe I'm being a bit hypocritical here because obviously I'm chatting with you, but there's sort of a cluster of quote unquote thought leaders in marketing that if you really unpack their resume, the reality is they probably haven't practiced in 10 years or more. A lot of the thought leaders are actually in revenue marketing are actually product marketers, even the analysts. So I would say that there's not necessarily like one person who's out there in the public, because I actually sometimes am a little bit critical of those folks that are speaking and not doing. I think that the difference between nailing it in revenue marketing and getting it entirely wrong is like 2 degrees of separation. It's a very precise practice. So I really want to learn from the practitioners. So that's why for me, I've spent a lot of time over the last 18 months with our customers and with our prospective customers, just talking to the people who are like in the day to day. They feel the pressure. They know the thing. They know the detail. I suppose there's probably some industries where details don't matter, but it's not in our industry. So I would actually say those peer-to-peer engagements, it's not probably exactly what you were hoping for, Tara, but those peer-to-peer engagements are so powerful. You know, maybe more podcasts like this where you're talking, you know, to the doers and the folks that are sort of in the weeds. That's where I think you really find the nuggets of truth that are maybe not pretty in a PowerPoint presentation, but they're really real and impactful for your business. So mm-hmm. I would say more practitioners, less thought leaders.
I love that. And for yourself, when you're looking to connect with customers, are you doing that yourself just one-on-one on LinkedIn? Do you use any kind of listening tools or social listening to connect with them?
You know, I'm so lucky that I'm a marketer and I sell marketing technology. Customers want to speak to us and want to sort of know how we use our own tool. And we've sort of figured out the ABM game, and they want to know, they want the details, right? They want me to pull up the spreadsheet that says, this is the dashboard that I literally look at. They want to know the, like, the real, right? So I actually am asked to speak to customers and prospective customers many times a week. So does my head of demand gen. So I think collectively, you know, we probably are on 5 or 6 calls a week, just hearing about people's businesses and maybe giving them a little bit of strategy that's very nuanced to their particular circumstances, because it could be very varied. So I'm lucky that I'm invited that way. I'm not necessarily finding folks and asking to speak with them, but more the other way around. But boy, I learn a lot from them as well. I learn a lot from them as well. Like, we share, we swap tips. I love talking to other practitioners in the space, because, yeah, like I said, like, it's like these, it, you know, my marketing isn't like, it isn't one thing. It's like, it's a thousand micro moments that you're building for your customer. And so I want to know what those moments are. Exactly. How did you do this? You know what I mean? What were the tools? What was the process? What was the signal? I want to know the details, because it is so specific. And like I said, I think you can get it wrong by making, you know, just slightly imprecise decisions on how you're setting things up. So I like to kind of get into the weeds there, and so do they. Yeah, that's how it works for me.
Cool. And I'm sure they're happy to have you as a resource. So it's a win-win for everyone.
I hope so. But I'm probably, like they say, that you know, the student often teaches the teacher. And I think that's definitely true for our customers.
Great. And is there an under the radar, could be a channel or maybe a tactic that your team is really loving right now?
I mean, I kind of said it earlier, but that hot context thing, I mean, it's such a game changer, because I think the reason why it's so powerful is that every investment that you're making today, it's just illuminating more of the demand impact that you're already investing. So it doesn't require additional investment. Like, it's not a new channel that you then need to, like, test and see how you get engagement and it costs money or whatever. Like, hot contacts, like, our customers can just start de-anonymizing their site traffic. And then suddenly that whole, like, fluffy awareness bucket that a lot of revenue marketers are like, oh, that's, you know, whatever, that's awareness, I don't care, suddenly becomes a demand channel for you, like, overnight. And I think it's been super powerful for us as we've been able to play with the alpha version of the product, where we're able to generate 100 more leads effectively every month, not doing anything differently, just having the sort of the insight to see, and then, you know, making sure that all those are through data workflow going to sales and they're following up. So it is not really a channel, so to speak, but I guess it's a data source or an intelligence source that has been opening up a lot of demand for us with no more work and no more money. Which, who doesn't love that right now?
Yeah, I'd love to read more about that when you get some time to put some resources together, because I think you're right. A lot of us, especially on the demand gen side, dismiss these awareness metrics as kind of fluff or things that we don't really want to report back.
And who cares about advertising engagement or, you know, site traffic when only a microscopic portion of those, you know, people are the right fit? But proof, if you know that they are the right fit and you know exactly who they are and you can make that match and pass it to sales, like, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So I think it's going to be a real game changer, frankly, at just a moment where we are so delighted to support our customers and prospective customers, hopefully, in, you know, just getting more from the investments that they're currently making and sort of support that journey to an efficient program. This is a lever that they can pull. So it's kind of under the radar, but just a few short weeks, it'll be out in public, and I'm pumped.
Great. And lastly, Jody, where can we go to find out more about you or maybe give you a follow somewhere?
Well, I'm not really fancy enough to have a following or a place to follow me, but I will say that my point of views often show up in the RuleWorks content, because we take that practitioner side so seriously. Oftentimes I'm a sniff test or a guiding light to some of the things that we're putting out as our own version of practical thought leadership, I'll say. So definitely a Rollworks blog is a great place to find me. I get personally, whether I'm writing or, you know, kind of in spirit as I'm influencing the content team and what they're putting out.
Great. And we'll obviously include those links in the show notes for anyone looking to check that out. I think, like you said, hearing from practitioners is really what a lot of us are looking for right now versus some of the fluff that we're maybe seeing on other channels. So definitely sounds like there's some insights there. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jody, for your time.
It's just been a pleasure.
And thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks with a brand new episode.
Thanks for listening to Demand Gen Chat. Demand Gen Chat is a Chili Piper podcast hosted by Tara Robertson and produced by me, Nola McCoy. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. It only takes 5 seconds and helps other marketers like you discover Demand Gen Chat. Also, if you'd like to have a question answered in a future episode, you can connect with Tara Robertson on LinkedIn. Send her a DM with your question and it could be answered on a future episode. Finally, if you've gotten this far and are wondering what Chili Piper even is, Chili Piper helps B2B marketers book more qualified meetings for their sales teams. You can't afford to leave opportunities on the table, so let your lead self-qualify and schedule a time with the right rep instantly. And that's just one of the many revenue-impacting things that Chili Piper does. Visit chilipiper.com to learn more. And thanks again for listening. We'll see you on the next episode of Demand Gen Chat.